Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you whisper.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, indeed. Let's get started here. Tonight, we have a very interesting author in the house. Please welcome to the show, Jefferson Davis.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Care to join me on a bit of a road trip? Well, pack your bags, everyone, because we are going to head out to the Pacific Northwest and take a side trip to Alaska. My guest this evening is Jeff Davis. Jeff Davis has a bachelor's degree in anthropology and a master's degree in archaeology. He lived in England for nearly a year while working on his master's degree on the Vikings in Greenland. He has also worked for field archaeologists for several years in the Pacific Northwest. Jeff spent many years in the U.S. military, serving in Italy, South Korea, Japan, Bosnia, and Afghanistan in a number of positions. He also, while being in the military, became a military historian and also put on puppet shows at orphanages. Jeff has written several books on military history, ghosts, mythology, and archaeology. His best-selling books are Weird Washington and Weird Oregon. Jeff has also been an expert on Coast to Coast AM, the History Channel TV show called Haunted History Northwest, Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, Ghost Adventures, Graveyard of the Pacific, The Dead Files, and That White People, S*T. So sit back, relax, and as they say, enjoy the show. Please welcome to the show my guest, Jeff Davis. Well, hello, Jeff, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Kelly. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm happy to be here with you.
So, Jeff, usually when I start out these shows, I start them out by asking just a general question so we can evolve it, of course, to where you are right now. And, of course, because this might be a little bit of a twist here, where did your interest start? And it can be just about anything. Did it start the paranormal, anything to do with cryptids, UFO, Bigfoot, you name it? Or did it start somewhere else? Let's use that and go back until your youngest age, and then we'll move it to where you are now.
Sure. I guess my interest in the paranormal began a little bit differently than a lot of people. When I was a kid, 7, 8, 9 years old, back in the 1960s, I got really interested in horror movies. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone remembers, they used to have drive-in theaters. And it was in that time period, there were the British Hammer Studios who made horror movies, all those Dracula movies, mm-hmm. Were releasing them in the U.S. And my dad wanted to see the movies, didn't have money for a babysitter, so we got to see the movies too. Yeah. And in late night TV, I remember really what crystallized my interest was the original Mummy with Boris Karloff in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And that, if anyone has a chance to see that or download it, I encourage you. Boris Karloff, he's only in the makeup as the mummy for about the first 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's a resurrected mummy, and then he sheds his bandages and he comes back and he interacts with living archaeologists. Mm-hmm. And there's all of this mix with magic and archaeology and reincarnation and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And that got me interested in anthropology and archaeology. And I went on to actually get a master's in archaeology. And part of that is myths and storytelling. And so, discussion about spiritual beliefs and ghosts. Mm-hmm. And so it was later, I'd always been interested in the paranormal and the spooky, but, when I had a lapse in work as an archaeologist, that's when I said, well, maybe I should just start following this other thread. And that's when I started writing and publishing my own books on ghosts.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And we should do just a, now, as you've heard and seen in the introduction, Jeff has written a couple books, Washington, or the kind of weird things going on in Washington, weird things going on in Oregon and stuff like that. So where his experience says, would you say this is fair? A lot of your experiences pretty much lie in the Pacific Northwest, or have you really delved into any other states throughout the United States that you're working on? But right now I see you pretty much as Pacific Northwest. What would you say?
Pretty much. What happens is sometimes I get work assignments. The books Weird Washington and Weird Oregon were not my own press. I actually wrote them under contract to Barnes & Noble. So sometimes I will get work requests because I do independent historic research as well as paranormal, and that'll take me somewhere else. Mm-hmm. For instance, I've appeared on the TV show Alaskan Killer Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. And I come on these shows oftentimes as a historical consultant. Mm-hmm. So I did a whole bunch of research and reading up on Alaska for that show. And actually international voyages of exploration, the Spanish exploration, English and American. So I get pulled different ways for the military because I'm retired military. I've actually visited the site of Custer's Last Stand and the Battle of Antietam. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like a shotgun approach sometimes is to I'll be talking to somebody and the subject will stray to Jack the Ripper. Well, I lived in England for a year and I have a friend who's a Ripper historian. And so I think I know a fair amount on Jack the Ripper, too.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And, you know, Jack the Ripper, everybody, well, not everybody, but many people seem to hear that. Would you call it folklore? Or what would you call it on Jack the Ripper?
There are definitely more myths and theories about who Jack the Ripper was than real evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And
yeah. Every year, I'd say every year, three or four books get published on Jack the Ripper. Mm-hmm. And every decade or so, there's like the highly touted, mm-hmm. I have found who Jack the Ripper is. Mm-hmm. And authors with a lot of chops, like Patricia Cornwall, put forth their own research. And then, unfortunately, when you write a book and you stake your reputation on it, then the critics show up. And so... I think they're me personally. I think Jack the Ripper will never find who Jack was because Jack was a face in the crowd.
Yep. Yeah. And a really good one at that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rather than some important person, because all the novelists seem to pick somebody famous.
Yeah. Well, and you understand that probably as well as I do, that, you know, I hate to say the word sex sells or anything like that, but it goes along that line. A lot of people for some reason are very intrigued by certain personalities or things like that, and that they, people who write about some of this stuff, some, not all, but you know, they figure out what they think will intrigue or interest the reader the most, and the reader just naturally gravitates to that. I mean, if you put on a in front of you, you know, average Joe Blow person, and then you put this other person or whatever, and which one would you rather watch or whatever on television? Chances are very likely you're going to pick the one you're either already familiar with or you think is going to be the most intriguing of the two, even though the average person probably has the better story and has lived through it as well. So I don't know if you ever have found that when you're writing, but I'm curious, as a writer, do you take those things into account, or how, what are some of the thoughts of the writer?
Because of my anthropology background, I do not take a stand. If I am writing about a haunted house, I don't take a stand to say this house is definitely haunted or this house is not, because it's the story of people. What makes a ghost story interesting to anyone is not necessarily the phenomenon, unless people are levitating and things like that, but it's really who did it, who is the ghost, and why.
Yeah,
that interests people. Ichabod Crane, the Headless Horseman. It's the story behind it that interests people, and haunted houses, haunted businesses. Usually the person who built it first or lived there first seems to be a primary candidate, and so we get their stories, and then I leave it for other people to make up their mind, because I have also in my own house. I had something die in the wall, some little rodent thing, and, you know, to somebody else, oh, no, it must be the smell of the ghost. No, it's the mouse. I had to remove the mouse with tweezers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Reasonable and ordinary phenomena can masquerade as a ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Scratching in the wall. Oh my goodness, there's scratching in the wall. Now, the one I can't ever explain usually is, unless it's a pipe, is knocking, knock, knock, or anything like that. Now, if they knock three times, then I get really, really worried, because, of course, that's a little bit more, we know that to be a little bit more demonic or negative. But the knocks I've always had have been usually just two, you know, and then it's kind of like, well, who's hanging about here and why? And of course, because we don't always see these entities, we create the mystery sometimes ourselves behind who we think we're dealing with, when it could be something completely different. Now, even though, and I'm going to ask this generally, I think you might have alluded to it earlier, that have you ever had any kind of a ghostly experience, even though you're doing research and have on different people's properties and stuff like that? Have you ever gone into these properties just to sense them out? And what has your experiences been like, per se, regarding the paranormal?
Right. My very first big thing that is hard to explain away actually happened. I live in Vancouver, Washington, and there's a decommissioned army base. It's called the Vancouver Barracks, and it's kind of famous now because I wrote about my experience. So it was a hospital built in 1904, and it was replaced by a different hospital in World War II. So it was a hospital for about almost 40 years, and it became an office building. It still exists, but it's not a hospital. But autopsies were done in the basement, and also in the basement was the morgue. And that had a reputation for being haunted before I was even on the scene. But I got permission to go there at night, day and night. And we were, myself, my wife, and a friend were down in the basement. And I was sleeping on a couch, and my friend was sleeping on top of a very large flat table. And in the middle of the night, I heard this squeaking noise, and I turned my head, and my friend on the table, laying on his back, the table with him on it was shaking back and forth, making the squeaking noise.
Okay, wow.
That is really hard to explain away as natural phenomena.
And of course someone would say tremors in the area, any type of movement like that, earthquake potential, stuff. Did anyone ever rule out the fact that something environmental was going on at the time in causing that? What are your thoughts on that?
I did not check with seismologists. Somebody suggested, and this is possible, that we were very close to a freeway, and that freeway noises or the vibrations, but then that would be a constant thing. Mm-hmm. You know, he was laying on that for 3 or 4 hours before that happened, and other people tried later. There, interestingly, because I don't even say debunking, but looking at the phenomena and trying to find a reasonable explanation, in the British Museum, in the Egyptology section, there was a statue in a display case.
Mm-hmm.
And that statue over a period of hours moved, macroscopic movement. So I think originally the statue was facing the front of the display case, mm-hmm. and over a period of a couple of hours, people found it turned around, mm-hmm. and they did time-lapse photography and found, yeah, it did. And that turned out to be traffic.
Traffic.
Yeah. They actually used seismographs to confirm that there was just some kind of harmonic tremor just in the right spot, mm-hmm. that moved that statue. So I'm open to other explanations, but I'll tell you, I don't think it was traffic.
Yeah, there are some, and I've been in those situations, by the way, Jeff. So I know that when, just as brief examples, I think when I lived in Indiana, we had, there was a very small earthquake that did happen, and it's not like Indiana's prone to earthquakes, but it just so happens that this one, and I found myself almost being flung out of bed. I mean, it everything tilted, and I jolted as if I was to fall over the side of the bed. The other thing you bring up, which has happens to me not daily but pretty frequently, mm-hmm. is when I'm in my office here. Anyone who does not know that we have a train that goes through just probably, I don't know, a half mile away or whatever, causes a vibration where all of a sudden everything in here starts to shake and move, and my computer screen literally goes upside down like that. So you and I'm sitting here now. Most people would, that if they're not aware of some of these tremors that go on or this vibrational mm-hmm. movement stuff that goes on, they would think, oh my God, I've got this really bad haunted room because my everything is shaking and moving and stuff, and freaks them out. Well, we also have in our garage, at which we were told when we moved into this house, they're I don't know how to describe them, but they're put on where the garage doors are. And the guy said, don't ever paint them, because in the event that there's any kind of a movement or we get some kind of unusual whatever, it helps the house to, or it helps keep stabilization within whatever the house or the whatever's going on. So I learned that early enough that there's the possibility that, or bad wind, I guess I'm thinking mm-hmm. tornado or wind or something like that. It all has to do with stabilizing the house. And so, but that's very interesting. But the thing is, yes, because you're already in a haunted morgue, perhaps a haunted morgue, I can't say that definitely, but it sounds pretty close. There are things that do hang around. And why they're rocking them back and forth, we'll never know. But how did he feel? Did he wake up during that experience when that happened?
Oh, yes. He actually was the skeptic who kept on saying, no, there's such a thing as ghosts.
Yeah.
And I'll add in, I did not wake up because the couch I was in was moving. I woke up because I heard that squeaking, but he was laying on his back, and he had turned his face toward me, and his eyes were quite large. and he whispered, "Table's shaking. It's not me." And he was more of a believer after that.
I think so. I think, you know, there's people, I mean, I Most of my friends, I'd say most of them, probably all of them, are skeptics. A lot of my family members are skeptics. You know, something goes on and they hear a little noise and all of a sudden they say, oh, you want to pass that off to be something else. And it's like, no, there's something about this noise or there's something about what's happening right now that's not necessarily typical. You have to be in this field a pretty long time, or at least understand through time your experiences where you can actually say to yourself, nah, that one I think is something else, or yeah, that one is very much unexplained. So can you tell us any interesting story that you may have written about? That was interesting, by the way. Do you have another one that involves paranormal activity that you might have written about that you can share?
Yeah, I you and I had chatted before we started this, and both of us have been doing this a while. Mm-hmm. And when you purposely go somewhere looking for the phenomena, it's like those crazy people chasing tornadoes. Yeah. Every once in a while, that tornado rounds back on you. Mm-hmm. So when I write a book, I do site visits, and mm-hmm. and some things tend to happen. And one of the more famous haunted locations in Portland, Oregon, is a place called the White Eagle Saloon. And it's that place has been there since, for about 100 years now, if not a little over 100 years. And it was a bar, and above that was a rooming house. And the owners lived in a suite of two rooms at the front of the building. And then one of the other rooms off to the side was occupied by a guy named Sam. Mm-hmm. And it's those three rooms that seem to have the most activity to people. Mm-hmm. So some time ago, I gathered together a bunch of curiosity seekers, and we rented the entire upper story and did all these paranormal experiments throughout the evening. Mm-hmm. And we were in the room that the owners, their bedroom, and we had a television crew filming us. And some people will be a little freaked out about this. Somebody brought a Ouija board. Mm-hmm. But we had a electro field detector, and this was one of the needle, you know, analog ones, not one of the blinky light things. Mm-hmm. And as we were starting to ask questions, I was there and holding the meter, and we had developed an idea about what's the baseline electromagnetic radiation here. We're filming. We haven't started questions yet. So we got a certain level, even with the camera going. Mm-hmm. And I want to say it was like 5 milligauss. Mm-hmm. And as the Ouija session progressed, the needle started moving up. And then when somebody asked certain questions, the needle would spike and then go back down.
Yeah.
That happened several times as if in response to the questions. Mm-hmm. But the EMF more than doubled during the length of this session, and there were questions for the primary ghost upstairs is supposed to be Sam. Mm-hmm. And we seemed to get a lot of responses. Mm-hmm. And this is also a case where if you're part of a group or a crowd and you get crowd emotions going in this feedback loop, it was a pretty interesting experience. And in the hallway there was a cold spot, and it had diameter. Mm-hmm. People could put their hands into it, and from all different angles, and it was finite in size. It was not moving or anything. And according to one of the clairvoyants, that was the ghost of the female ghost, Rose. She was standing there watching us.
Interesting. Did you say they're putting their hands, they could see this mass or this orb or whatever, something hanging about? Did you say that in the middle of the hall, and they're trying to put their hands through it?
Nobody could actually see it. It was just one of the clairvoyants said, there's a cold spot here. This is the ghost, and said, here she is.
Okay.
And kind of sized the spot.
Yeah.
And people were putting their hands in to that spot from different angles. And indeed, it was a cold spot. Had it been a draft,
yeah,
there should have been some movement to it.
Yeah.
And people would have, you know, it was very, actually a very small area. And it was there for about 45 minutes and then it just dissipated.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the question some people might ask is, was it, did the clairvoyant or the psychic determine if the ghost of, did you say Rose, was residual or intelligent? Did you ever get down to wondering about that?
No, we never asked that. And that is a good question. There seemed to be responses to questions, and residuals generally are not,
they don't respond. No, yeah. They just kind of sit there and look straight ahead and nothing you can do. It's not like, now if they turn their head all of a sudden and looked at you, that would creep me out and I'd probably take off running, you know. But if you visually saw them, right, or even if it was translucent. Yeah. I'm always fascinated by when I hear reports of where you're at. I was in that, I can't remember the name of the house, but I had someone from the, Jeff and I met at the Oregon Ghost Conference. And so, you're probably taking note that many of the people this season are from that conference, and they are, because they're very interesting. Plus I'm from the Midwest. And so I just love it when I can go into different territories in the United States as well as Europe. And talk to people about, well, what's happening in your territory. But Jeff, I was in that one place, and I think it was in Astoria, that was known to be, I think, a haunted house of some sort, and people can go in and do tours in it. And I was talking to one of the other individuals from the conference that I interviewed, and I stood right on the spot where this one particular ghost liked to show up in the upper level. But somebody in that house actually saw somebody in a period gown walking through, and then they made a comment to, you know, the reception person or whatever. That's really cool that you have somebody walking through in period clothing, and they go, we don't have anybody walking in this house in period clothing. Have you ever heard of, because I'm not sure if you've ever seen, but have you ever heard of anything like that out in your area, that people have actually seen in their period clothing or whatever, these an apparition? We'll just start with that.
Yes, there are several different places, and I think you were probably at the Flavel House.
Oh yes, that's the Astoria. One. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually at the Flavel House, which is open as a museum, and it was, I think it's still the finest house. It was the finest house built in the 1800s in Astoria. Mm-hmm. And people have seen, and according to this one woman who used to be one of the tour guides, she had shut down, and her family came and they were walking around the outer gardens outside. Mm-hmm. And she had them pose with the house in the backdrop. Mm-hmm. And through the window, she got photographs that showed two women inside looking out at them in period clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And same house, and Captain Flavel, his room on the upper floor, he and his wife had separate bedrooms. And in his room, people have seen him in his room. And so supposedly the entryway from the hallway to his room, this one clairvoyant declared that to be the entryway into the door into hell. And
Well, the reason why I say that is because I was in his room. Yep. And that's what I had heard. Oh, people have a tendency to see this man in this room, right? Mm-hmm. My husband and I walked through, I think it was kind of like you can walk through one door and then out the other. I cannot recall this.
It's like a dressing room. Yeah.
Yep. And we were walking and I said, stop. I said this to my husband. I said, stop. I said, it's right here. Whatever it is, I feel it. It's right here. I feel there's something weird happening to me right now. I feel tingles or something like that. And then when we went downstairs, there was actually a book sitting in the bookshelf that you could buy or something like that. And I said, oh, look at here. There's a book on this house. And I flipped and it was the exact spot I was standing in. But I want you to explain, are you telling me that I was actually standing on a spot that was to go to hell or something, or what?
Well, that was a declaration made by a clairvoyant person, and the local radio station, this is a couple decades ago, did a Halloween broadcast while the broadcaster's actually like laying on the floor in the doorway.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the pronouncements. And setting aside what may have been a reaction to the power of the energy there, nobody else has ever reported being harmed, but they have felt and seen what they believe is the presence of Captain Flavel. He's almost playful, or he's almost just like letting people know he's there. There was a docent some years ago who was up there, and she was vacuuming the carpet in there, and the vacuum cleaner was unplugged. So take notice of me, or I don't like the noise, or kind of almost like a play for poltergeist kind of an effect.
Yeah, I thought that I was standing on top of him. I mean, like he was standing there, and then we're walking through, and it's all of a sudden like, I feel funny, and I feel tingly, and I feel cold, and I said to my husband, I said, it's right here. This is the spot. I'm standing on this man, or he's standing right next to me. But when I saw it in the book, and the book actually described where these spots were, or these, you know, hot spots were in that room, that was one, if not the spot, that I just was like, how could I have known that? You know, it was just like, what other things have you researched that you could talk about in that area?
Well, can I actually move up a little bit to Alaska? Yeah.
Yes, of course. Go.
Okay,
go.
Great. Well, one of the television shows that I appeared on last is called, I did not pick the name, Alaskan Killer Bigfoot.
I know.
And it's a sensational name, but it pretty much says it all. I've noticed in the last couple of years, I have not normally, I write about cryptids in my books, but I have not, you know, focused and specialized in them per se. And so I had to do research on Native American cultural traditions, as well as a historic background on European exploration in the whole Pacific Northwest for this show. And kind of in the background, I've noticed that amongst people who are Bigfoot researchers, or they're enthusiasts, or they're curious, there's almost like a dividing line where some people, and I've said this jokingly, tend to think that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, is just some cute, cuddly Ewok on steroids, that they just want to give you a bear hug and in a Slim Jim or something like that, like the commercials. But the historic record, and this includes statements from native folk to anthropologists, it's a lot more complex than that. And all too often, it is not a sign of good fortune to be walking in the woods and see a Sasquatch. Oftentimes misfortune follows, because to some people, they're not just a biological being. Some kind of a hominid. They're not some kind of a critter related to man. They have supernatural powers, or they are not always very friendly. And so I've kind of come upon that, and especially in researching for Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, various stories of things like separating out what's a Sasquatch from what's an ogre, I don't know, but that they come down out of the mountains, or used to at times, and they would pick up live humans and carry them up to wherever their lair was and eat them.
Oh,
and yeah, and among other things, they did have these special magical powers. They could make their voices sound like somebody else's. You hear about a Wendigo.
Yeah.
So they have this power of mimicry. Also, oftentimes they would make like bird sounds, but they were hypnotic, in that people would actually be mesmerized by it. And then they would, like the Pied Piper, go leave their houses and go out into the woods to where the Sasquatch was waiting for them. And so it has really been interesting having an opportunity to dig into that. Because oftentimes for me, what happens, I'm not sure about you, I will get a work assignment that comes in, out of the blue, somebody wants to know about this. And then I hit the books, I hit the internet, and then I get caught up on it. And so it's some cases across the country, some areas I know a whole bunch about, but everything around them I don't know anything about. You know, Lizzie Borden murder house, Jack the Ripper, because I had work assignments come in. And so it's the same thing. And that show, Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, has been on for one season, and it has quite a fan base. Over, I'm not sure, their Facebook fan page has over 16,000 people.
Wow.
And we're still hoping to get renewed for second season, because the reason the show exists is because a whole bunch of horrific things happened in the early part of the 20th century. There was a Native American fishing community and a cannery there, and in 1949 the Bigfoot, the Nantinak, was so scary they abandoned the town site.
Mm-hmm.
And the land is still owned by the tribe, and so they're thinking about going back, and so that's why they came back to that place. And so they still need a place to live.
So a couple questions regarding all this. You brought up a couple points that I recall from an interview of talking with a gentleman a long time ago who talked about missing persons in national parks. But let's start with the one thing that I remember hearing about, and more so about lately. The mimicking that one might hear when in some of these forested areas regarding the possibility of being lured into a place that may or may not have something there of your best interest. So for an example, just exactly what you're talking about, I recall this story of when I was interviewing this guest of people going on this trail in a national park that was heavily forested. And it was, now that you mention it, I think this forest resided somewhere in like the California / that ridge area, you know, where it's heavily wooded. And that the rangers had to learn after a while that when they heard coming from the woods, "Help me, help me," and it sounded like an older man or a baby crying, or a child saying, "Please come and help me, I don't know what to do," or anything like that, that would be the lure of them going into those woods to who knows what they would actually have found. And so, you know, you have to really know your stuff to know the difference between if it's really a human being that needs help, truthfully, or whether or not it's a lure. And there was a story that he also told about, you know, because we were talking about portals and we were talking about people, actually one person going into a portal and not coming back out for about 14 days and was delirious and didn't know where he was and just kind of like was out of it. But there was a story about a Bigfoot that was seen in one of the national parks. Now, this wasn't up in Alaska, but it's very close to what we're talking about, because they can come down. I mean, we don't know if they have come down. And so he did pick up somebody, a child went missing. And then when they looked, the family, they saw this Bigfoot carrying off this young boy with him, and they couldn't catch up or couldn't retrieve the boy, and they never saw the boy again. And there have been stories, another story there too, where I remember someone saying that they, and these are true stories, people, these aren't made up things or fantasy. Another one where they discovered their young boy, but he was laying on a flat rock out in the middle of the forest somewhere. Unfortunately, his clothes were off, they're nicely folded, sitting next to him and or by him, as but he, the child, was of course deceased and dead. But why he was laying on this rock, or why he was put there with his clothes nicely folded next to him, remains a mystery. You bring up a good point about up there in Alaska. Is there any one part of Alaska? Now watch, tourism will fall based on what you say. So of course we don't want to. Is there areas or concentrations of areas up in Alaska where this stuff is happening more than others? What are your thoughts on that?
This is one of these cases where I have not looked at the map plots. There are Bigfoot organizations up in Alaska that would probably be able to show you demographically on a map. Mm-hmm. This particular place is known as Portlock, Alaska, and it's on the Kenai Peninsula by the Cook Inlet. If you're looking at a map, near Kodiak Island. Kodiak Island is there off the coast, and you just go back towards where the peninsula is, mm-hmm. and Portlock is very close to the tip of the peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And that area was actually visited by European explorers, English explorers and Spanish explorers and Russian explorers, and is actually mentioned in their journals. And the day that the Spaniards arrived and laid claim to the land for the King of Spain, mm-hmm. 8 sailors died of scurvy. That's what the log says. But it's kind of interesting. All at once, you have this disaster happen. And it could be chance, or as some people believe, that's kind of a curse.
There, I think what I'm learning about different Sasquatches or Bigfoot is that they're different in different parts of the country. And I mean, like the United States. And what are your thoughts about that? Because, and they also act differently. Some are more aggressive and some are less aggressive. What are your thoughts on that?
And this would just be speculation. It may well be that, and the native folk up in the Pacific Northwest actually say there are different types. There were very tall Sasquatch and very short ones. And the short ones were more malicious. They were the ones who could make the bird voices. Mm-hmm. So it may well be we've got different species. As an analogy, if you go online and start doing a Google search for how many human species have there been, it used to be people thought, well, there's Homo erectus, and then there's Neanderthal, and then Homo sapiens, and no, we've got Homo denisovans, and we've got Homo floresiensis, and I recently saw somebody speculating that in the last 30 or 40,000 years, there may well have been 5, 6, or 7 different human species that our ancestors managed to outcompete. And so why not different species of I use the word critter. A lot of anthropologists will say critter when the kind of the dividing line is what is man-like and what is not. What are the characteristics? Hominoid versus hominid, mm-hmm. and so when you've got something that's gray, then it's just a critter. And so what if there are 3 or 4 species of critters in the paleoanthropologists talk about Australopithecus afarensis and Boisei. One's very, very short, one's very, very tall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer to that, but this is why we ask questions. This is why we do research, even if it's university professors in field schools, or it is quote amateurs. And all too often I found amateurs tend to do maybe even a little bit more conscientious work because they're doing it because they like it and they want to do it, not because they're being paid.
There always seems to be blue glowing lights that are associated with them. What have you heard out in your area or up in Alaska?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because we chatted briefly before we started and you'd not seen any of the show episodes. Mm-hmm. Shame on you. But
promise I'll see one.
But I got to be clear, I was not physically in Portlock while they were investigating. But yes, indeed, there seemed to be some loci, locuses of energy and happenings, and they did have bright light coming from the area that was the scary tree. And it looked like it was on fire. And when they came to investigate, nothing was burned. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they have had light effects. One person speculated that it may well be some kind of extra-dimensional portal as opposed to being able to survive underground, that they may be entering from one place to the next, electromagnetic energy exchange and so on. So, yeah, they had several instances where that was happening. And there is an obelisk up there that I would like to investigate more. It's definitely got stones and concrete and things like that on it, but it's in an area that you question why put up a big huge stone marker in this spot. And so then and they found not too far away there was a human created kind of a pit that they excavated out, and they found Spanish coins dating to the 16th or 17th century there. So yeah, it is one of these cases where you start mixing all this up. I've taken us a little bit farther from your initial question, but that area, and I suspect almost any place where there are consistent sightings and witness accounts, you are going to find that they continue in the future, and they need investigating.
Do you know much about the pirate ships and stuff like that off on the coast of Oregon or Washington, that they're now that's becoming kind of an interesting thing that's now just going to, I think, develop and happen? What do you know about anything regarding that?
Yes, there definitely was piracy. It is not as well documented as the Caribbean, but after the Spaniards conquered Latin America and Mexico, off of the west coast of North America, they had their own merchant treasure fleets, just like from Hispaniola and the Caribbean going to Spain. These treasure fleets went through the Pacific, but also they went and crossed over to Spain the long way around Africa. And so the normal voyage might well be starting with gold or silver or other artifacts from South America, going off the coast of Central California. They would start heading south. There was a natural Pacific current, trade current, that would actually kind of take them south, but then they would fetch up on the Asian side near Japan or the Philippines, and they might well trade. Initially, they tried trading with Japan, and Japan closed themselves off, but they're trading in the Philippines for beeswax, among other things, and porcelain, and they're trading furs from North America over there. And in some cases, these ships would, loaded with beeswax and porcelain, actually jump back on the trade current and find their way back to North America. Some of these ships went south around Asia, India, and back to Spain with their treasure. And in some cases, in several cases, ships were lost and there's no record what happened to them.
Yeah.
And in other cases, yes. And privateering and piracy, it's really hard telling what might have been an actual shipwreck in a storm, or somebody whose ship is plundered. During the American Civil War, we know that there were Confederate raiders trying to find American shipping in the Pacific. So it's, and who knows, it is probably still going on in the Pacific. I'm not sure how close to the United States waters it is, but and many dozens and dozens of Japanese junks, the ships were called junks, were caught in storms and put into that trade current. And there were a few cases where, in historic record, where these Japanese ships found themselves washed ashore off North America.
Huh. Interesting.
And, yeah. And how long had that been going on? We don't know.
What has your experiences been like where you live or where you've been? Have you ever encountered or heard of or have known anyone who had some kind of a extraterrestrial or a UFO experience?
Yes. I do know people who believe they have, not believe, who have had UFO experiences. And I've not met with anybody, or let's face it, in the society in which we live, even though things are getting a lot more open,
even
to a close friend saying, oh, by the way, not only did I see a UFO, but it landed and took me aboard.
Yeah.
That is something that is really not common for people to admit to, unless they trust you a whole bunch or they're doing it anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
So some of my friends or acquaintances who have said that they have seen UFOs, I would suggest a small percentage of them did experience actually going on board the ship or some kind of contact, because we've got to separate out UFO in its barest essence is an unidentified flying object.
Right.
Separating out what's natural phenomena to the unexplainable, it still hasn't landed yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens when it's landed, and it gets smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But for historic background, some of the earliest UFO sightings in modern history took place in Washington State in the 1940s. A gentleman's flying an airplane. His name is Kenneth Arnold, and he saw a flight of UFOs. And based on his description, the word flying saucer was invented about Kenneth Arnold's sightings. And there was another case on a place called Maury Island, M-A-U-R-Y Island, in the Puget Sound, where the first mention of donut-shaped UFOs was made.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a long history and tradition. And partly what's the government was concerned, too, is especially from the 40s and 50s, fear that there would be some kind of forest fire in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Because not a lot of people know this, but during World War II, the Japanese, you talk about Chinese balloons,
mm-hmm.
The Chinese military released hundreds, if not thousands, of balloons across the Pacific, and they floated to the United States. They had incendiary bombs where they were trying to burn the United States forest down.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so these days we have a much better road network to cross connect, but there have always been cases where people who are like on fire watch towers have seen things they couldn't explain. And I've read through some of those logs, and even in the 1950s, it was unusual to see an airplane flying over the Cascade Mountains. So they would note those kind of sightings in their logbooks.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the stigma you were talking about, why are we having this interest now? There's always been an interest, but there's been such a stigma for people who openly said, I'm interested and I want to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finally coming out of that.
The conferences, do you find that when people approach you at your booth, who are the people approaching you?
Over and above everything, I would say they are friendly. You and I both done events where you don't have to be psychic to know from the way that person's walking up to you that they're just going to give you a hard time.
Yeah.
The demographic at this conference, of course, is a ghost conference. So people are there because they're curious.
Mm-hmm.
Having told you that, and you'll be familiar with this, a whole bunch of people drag their spouses who are not interested there.
That's
too.
That's correct.
But also at this conference, it takes place on spring break weekend for schools.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of families that are looking for something to do. But mm-hmm. over and above all, aside from the trapped prisoner spouses,
mm-hmm.
Everybody is curious, and it's an open kind of an open environment, and that's all to the good, I think. In some cases, maybe people can be a little overly credulous,
mm-hmm.
but you know what? Be respectful. Mm-hmm. If you think this person is a little out there, maybe because they're shaken by their experiences, just give them a little respect as a human being. Nothing says you have to go back to their booth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that to be a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. Because I do write books, I have a lot of people come up and want to talk books, so they want to share their story. Like, can you put this story in your next book?
Could you sense anything different or any experiences at all over there with your travels?
I don't think anything's ever followed me home.
No.
Or attached itself to me. I had two separate clairvoyants tell me at different occasions, they were not related, that variations of my chakras don't go very deep through my body, or my psychic vibration is at such a low level it's not perceived by paranormal entities. Either way, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But I was just coming back only a week or so ago. One of the places that we stopped at was in Scotland, a place called Inverary.
Okay.
And it's off of Loch Lomond. It is regionally famous because of its preserved jails. Huh. And there's a museum, and the two jail buildings, like here in the United States, you expect something out of like a John Wayne movie, the county jails, like a small brick lockup. Mm-hmm. No, huge, massive stone buildings with iron bars in the windows, multi-story. And there were two separate buildings built at different times. One of them is supposed to be the more humane, mm-hmm. kind of like a Calvinist ideal of we will reform people by making them work.
Mm-hmm.
But they were jailing 9-year-old boys for various acts of vandalism and things. And in, I believe this was the newer jail dating to the mid 1800s. They still had, switching, and that is flogging with a bundle of willow rods and sticks and twigs. And they built a framework out of wood. It's like a tabletop with a couple of holes in it, and they would put the person's arms down into the holes, and then they would fasten their wrists together and hold them there in place while they were switching, caning, flogging, whatever you want to call it. And I asked the docent, the gentleman who was in the building, I said, anything ghostly happened? Because that place has been on at least one television show about the paranormal. And I will not do my imitation Scottish accent, which is terrible. But he said, now that you mention it, last month, he'd only been there for like, I think, 2 months, if I'm remembering mm-hmm. the details. He said he was standing at the entrance to the building, and he and another docent heard the sound of somebody being whipped, you know, swoosh, and yelling going on, and they went to the end of the hallway where this room was, and they looked inside, and typical, just as they enter the doorway, all the sound stops.
Silent.
Nothing happened, no one there.
Yep.
Now, so I went there with a friend, and so I was videotaping with my camera, and so I was in there, and she was walking behind me, and I heard what sounded like a man moaning, very, very low toned. And so as I was recording, I was hoping it was catching on the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up saying to my friend was coming in. She had hard sole shoes, and I could hear her feet scraping on the floor, and I kept on going, shh, shh, and she kept on moving.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finally turned around and looked at her, and she was wearing headphones listening to a description of the room. So she didn't even hear me. So there was no witness to this. And all you could hear is me going, shh, and the sound of her walking. So the one thing all of us want is we want a witness with us so that somebody else is crazy too.
tell everybody a little bit about how they can get a hold of you and find you and watch anything that you may have posted. Take it from there.
Sure. Probably the easiest way to get a hold of me is through my website. It's spelled out all one word, ghostsandcritters.com. Now, I'm transitioning websites from an information website more to a WordPress website. So when you type that in, follow the link, you'll actually have a little redirect button that says, if you stay here in 10 seconds, you'll go to the new site, click on the logo and visit Jeff's older site. And on my new site, I have a link about events. So you can actually look at my calendar, see where I'm going. And if you want to see what I've been in before, I have a link to my IMDb account. And so every single one of these appearances that I've made on these television shows, you can follow those links and probably be able to watch it streaming through various services.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And I sell my books off my website too.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for being on the show today.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been fun.